So this is our fourth day of this four-day retreat here in Tampa, October 2-12, using the life and teachings of Milarepa to convince us that awakening is possible for everyone. Today, I'll be sharing some final teachings with you. And because this is our final day and because the retreat will be ending in a few hours, which means we will be dismantling the boundaries of our retreat that we set up. We will be taking down the physical boundaries, so we will be able to go out from the Franciscan Center and re-enter the geography of our normal life, as well as there'll be a little loosening of the strictures about past and future. But hopefully they will stay pretty firmly in place from now on. But I do want to kind of pull down one barrier just for the teaching, and that is between the present and the future. Usually we bring the future into the present. We think about, we fantasize about, we worry about, we plan about the future in our present. So we sort of contaminate our capacity to live fully in the present. But there is another way, in which I recommend we do this morning, which is to take the present into the future. So what that means is, as you are listening to these teachings this morning, please also, at the same time that you're listening deeply, in a sense, reflect how you can bring them into your life in the future. You know, the teachings of Dharma are readily available today, very easily. There's one access. One doesn't have to even leave one's home. One can read, one can watch DVDs, listen to tapes. And if one goes on the internet, one has access to pretty much every Buddhist teacher in the world. So there is an endless opportunity for us to access teachings. But as many of you know, that is only the first step. If there is not deep reflection on the teachings, and if there is not then practice of those teachings that one has deeply reflected on, there will be no digestion. If there is no digestion of food, no nutrition will come to one. So in the same way, the teachings we received, we need to think about in a deep way. What do they mean? What do they mean to me? How does one practice? How does one live by them? If I practice and live by them, what changes would I make in my life? So in this way, the teachings become yours. Until you reflect on them, until you chew on them, the teachings aren't yours. They're just, they're somebody else's, and you're just kind of storing them on a shelf in your mind. But they are, they have no use unless you use them. And so that is why, if you wonder why I've been practicing all these years and I've read so much and I've heard so many teachings and been on retreat, you know, why am I still dealing with the same stuff that I dealt with years ago? It's because you keep your teachings on the shelf. You have not digested them. And when you have digested them, you need to then take the energy that they give you and use them. Then you have, then then you have completed the purpose of teachings. Right? The Buddha's teachings are not to help you feel good. Many people like coming to Dharma talks because they feel good. Many people like to come to retreat because it feels good. They feel good for a few days. But if you then you leave your retreat and you go back and recreate your misery, your dissatisfaction, and continue to live in the same way you've always done, it'll be of no benefit to you. Buddhist teachings are meant to transform you. Buddhist teachings are meant to wake you up. If you don't leave retreat feeling more awake, clearer, more purposeful, more energized in your discipline, then retreat has not been beneficial to you. Right? Many people practice Dharma like they take drugs. Right? Short-term feel good. But then you come down. And let me say something about our good friend Milarepa. I know many people are a little uncomfortable with him because he is so extreme. But let me put it in another context. Milarepa is a whistleblower. He's a whistleblower. And you know, people in the company where there is malfeasance going on or being covered up or not looked to, they don't like their whistleblowers, do they? Awful whistleblowers pay the price, don't they? And the same way in human history, whistleblowers pay the price. They often get killed. Jesus Christ gets killed, right? Gandhi gets killed, Martin Luther King gets killed. So whistleblowers pay a price for pointing out what they see. Milarepa, whatever you may think of his lifestyle, he's a whistleblower. He sees something in life. He sees the way people are going about their lives that is fundamentally unsatisfactory, is not productive of meaning and happiness. He sees incredible waste. He sees human beings having this jewel of a mind, this jewel of awareness, this jewel of their capacity to live a life of deep understanding and love and compassion and selflessness. And he sees them just, pissing it away on one little petty activity after another, one little petty ego drama after the other, right? And so, he points that out. He's a whistleblower. And we should appreciate whistleblowers, even though, we think we've been benefiting from what's been going on. He's showing us another way. And it is often his extreme language, his extreme words, and more by that, his extreme lifestyle, which is a complete rejection of ours. Right? We live for comfort. We live for safety. We live for security. We live for continuity, We live for little gains, right? Our life is based on goals and objectives that we're always adding to. Right? And his life is not about that at all. And for all the things that we build our life about, and we talked about our bodies and everything else, he's totally dismissive. So again, as lay people, while we may not be willing or able to follow his call and his lifestyle in the dramatic way that he calls us, we could at least heed the message and see if there's some truth into it. You know, he may be pointing something out that we are missing. You know, we are all, you know, it is very easy when we are living a certain life, and especially if we're living in a world where everybody seems to be in agreement that these are the purpose and meaning and goals of a life, it's very easy to not think out of the box. Not even to realize we're in a box. But then along comes somebody by the Rambam, and he very clearly points out the box. And not only does he point out the box, he wants no part of it. Right? He's willing to starve to death rather than to be part of it. So, you know, we could just say he's a madman. He's sick. We could say, gee, maybe there's a grain of truth. Maybe there's something that he sees that we don't see. And of course, the fact that, you know, 1,000 years later, we are reading his story and thinking about and reflecting on his life among many others who do that, that shows that there may be something to this green man. You know, I couldn't find it, but there's a somewhere, and I remember reading years ago, there's a wonderful song he sings called the Song of the Broken Pot. And I couldn't find it, so I don't know, I don't think I'm making it up. You know, he was down to, he just had one pot. I mean, that was his only implement. And he used it to go to the stream and get water. And then he used it to cook his nettle soup. I mean, but that was his only implement. And one day, it is said, he was either walking to the stream or not with his pot, and he tripped. And the pot fell to the ground and broke. And he sings that in that moment, he was just devastated. Oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, just devastated. And all of a sudden it struck him. Look at me, a free yogi. And look how attached I am to this. You know, I'm down to one pot. And I am as attached to that one pot as all these worldly people are until they're, you know, to their 50 pots. I mean, it's interesting. And he sings a song about himself. You know, and here he, you know, how he thought he was so free and so unattached. And he had realized he had just taken all these attachments that everybody else puts among, you know, 100 different things, and he had just put it on his pot. Because when that pot broke, he was devastated. So it's a good song. So we don't have a lot of time this morning. I wanted to read something. This is the life of Gampopa. Gampopa was his major disciple. He had many disciples, several hard sons. But Gampopa was the one. He was actually a physician in his life before he became a student, and had been married and had children. Both his two children and his wife had died in some kind of epidemic. And actually he was a physician taking care of people, but both his son and his daughter and his wife died. And after that, he kind of renounced worldly life and went off in search of a teacher and eventually met Milarepa. And again, he had a long association with Milarepa, practiced under him, before he went out and began to teach himself. And this is Milarepa's final instructions and farewell to him. So they walk together for a while, father and son. The morning air was fresh and warm, the sky was cloudless and clear. A gentle breeze stirred the spring mountain flower blossoms as Milarepa and Gampopa walked along the eastern path. I mean, so beautiful, the writing. When they came to a stone bridge, Milarepa said, "My dear monk, as a good omen, let us not cross the river together. Here now, put down your load, and let us father and son talk a while." He took his hand. Sitting by the river, Mila took his hand and said, "My dear monk." It was actually, Gampopa was a monk. He had been ordained as a monk, monk physician. "My dear monk, stay free of pride and self-centeredness." So you can imagine he's giving this advice to you. "Stay free of pride and self-centeredness. Cut the bonds of affection and attachment. Abandon all worldly desires for this life. These are the things a good Buddhist yogi," so again, he's a yogi. "My son, do not fall in with those whom the three poisons of greed, hatred, and ignorance are strong, lest they influence you with their poison." Again, I won't read everything, but I'll just... "There are people who are so full of anger that they see nothing but others' faults and take everyone to be their enemies. They're always heaping abuse on everyone, criticizing everything, and they're a bad influence on others. Some people, they're so greedy, they grasp and store up everything, even if it's only an old piece of wood or a handful of pebbles. They say, 'When I grow old, I'll need some things. When I die, I'll need food for offerings.' So they insist one cannot practice the Dharma without money. Everybody needs money, and they engage in all kinds of profit-seeking. Their blood is always boiling with greed. And there are others who will say, 'Now is not the time for us to practice the transcendental teachings. One should never stick to one teaching, or one will wind up bigoted, fanatical, narrow-minded. Besides, you can't achieve Buddhahood in one lifetime.' That is why," at the end he says, "that is why you should stay away from people who are dominated strongly by the three poisons of hatred, greed, and ignorance. In general, you should be full of mindfulness, like a tiny cautious sparrow or a wounded deer. Do not let yourself grow prideful over your discipline, lest you poison all the merit you have gained. Be kindly to every being and in harmony with all. Be peaceful, compassionate, patient. Live purely. You should bridle your wandering thoughts and avoid the temptation of distractions and idle chatter. You should dwell instead in quiet mountain retreats, seldom leaving your meditation seat. Spend your time furthering your practice." And he goes on to... And then he sings him a song. "My son, when ultimate reality beyond description appears in your mind, do not be tempted to engage in sophistries, lest you become proud and get caught up in the eight worldly dharmas. Rest in humility, free from arrogance. Do you understand this, my son? When liberation arises within you, do not be tempted to engage in logical speculation, lest you waste your time in useless exertion. Son, rest in the state free from discursive thought. Do you understand this? When you realize the empty nature of mind, do not get caught up in ideas of one or many. Rest at ease in the sphere of simplicity, beyond words. Do you understand this? When you practice, do not busy yourself with daily rituals and endless virtuous deeds, lest your wisdom of non-distinction vanish. Son, rest in the unfabricated innate nature of mind. Do you understand this? When revelations, visions, prophecies arise, do not fixate and grow prideful or overjoyed, lest you the prophecies become the words of delusion. Son, rest at ease. Cling to nothing. Do you understand this, my son? When you see penetratingly into your own mind, do not yearn for higher perceptions, lest you be caught by delusion and desire, joy, or pride. Son, rest at ease in the state free from hope. Do you understand this? O monk, O physician. I want you to pay very close attention to this. We're about to get the most profoundest of teachings. Then Milarepa placed his feet upon the crown of Gampopa's head and said, "Noble monk, I have just imparted to you all the four initiations. Now be happy, be full of joy." Thus in word, song, and gesture, Milarepa conferred upon Gopa the four initiations with his feet. The act of putting his feet upon Gampopa's head symbolized that in addition to everything else, Milarepa had given the disciple the Vajra Guru empowerment, which authorized Gampopa to be a Dharma teacher. He also gave Gampopa the initiation of expression samadhi and then said to him, "I have an unusually profound pith instruction, but it is too precious to give away. I am through now, son. You may go." Milarepa then embraced Gampopa and bid him farewell on his journey. Gampopa hoisted his pack and crossed the stone bridge, leaving Milarepa standing back on the other side of the river. Gampopa knew that Milarepa had already transmitted all the lineage teachings and wondered what this more profound doctrine could be. He continued walking east, but when he reached a distance, barely within earshot of where Milarepa stood, he heard his lama calling. Turning, he saw Milarepa quite far away now, motioning him to come back. Puzzled, Gampopa walked back and again crossed the stone bridge to see what it is his lama wanted, his teacher wanted. His eyes burning brightly, Milarepa said to him, "Who else but you deserves to receive this most precious, quintessential instruction, even though it be of too great a value to be given away? Now come here, and I will give it to you." Gampopa was overjoyed and asked, "Should I first offer you a mandala? I may make you an offering." And Milarepa says, "No, my son, it is not necessary for you to offer me a mandala. I only ask that you cherish this teaching and never waste it." He then took Gampopa by the hand and led him behind a rock, a big boulder that was nearby. He said to him, "Now look." And with that, he hoisted the back of his robe, revealing the cheeks of his buttocks, all covered with lumps of hard callus, like the hooves of an animal, due to having sat for so long on stony ground without a cushion. He said, "There is no more profound teaching than this. Now you can imagine the hardships I have undergone. My attainment of full enlightenment, great realization, came from this. It has simply been due to persistent effort that I have accumulated merit and gained accomplishment. You need such effort, not any other doctrine. This is the essence of my teaching. Whether you become a Buddha or not depends on effort, your effort. With it, there can be no question about your liberation. Like a good son, do what your father says. You should likewise continue to exert yourself with great perseverance in your meditation. You should continue sitting on one seat in one place until you attain realization. This is the most profound teaching in Buddhism. And it is said here that this teaching made an indelible impression on Gimpopa, giving him inspiration and courage on many occasions thereafter. Gimpopa expresses heartfelt gratitude to Milarepa, and thus, on a sunny, clear spring morning, father and son parted. And when he heard that Milarepa had died, this is several years later, Gimpopa sang this song to his teacher. Jetson, this was another name for Milarepa, Jetson. When you stand at the summit of the White Snow Mountain, your deeds are like a white snow lioness. You are the yogi who conquers the views of others. When you go into the forest, your actions are like the striped tiger. You are the yogi who is free from hope and fear. When you go to the white rock peak, your way is that of the white vulture. You are the yogi who has conquered space. When you wander without a care in mountain solitude, your path is like that of a wild animal. You are the yogi who is free from attachment. Your actions are like an elephant's. You are truly beyond meditation and post-meditation. Jetson, whose actions are childlike, you are truly free from inhibition. Jetson, whose actions are beyond concepts, you have truly realized the Dharmakaya, the body of Buddha. Jetson, you have the highest perceptions. You have merged your inner mind with luminosity. Your thoughts, Jetson, whose thoughts for food or drink are slight, you truly enjoy the food of samadhi. Jetson, like a wish-fulfilling gem, whatever one needs, one receives from you. Jetson, like the full moon among a sky full of stars, you are the most lovely among many. Jetson, like the lotus rising above the mud, you are unstained by the faults of samsara. Your virtuous qualities are without merit. All my praise is but a trifle. Hold me close with your compassion and accept me, even though I have no material gifts of veneration to offer. I will practice until we become one in the Dharma body. Do not cease your river of blessings. Do not let me go from the iron hook of your kindness. Through the virtue of these praises, may I meet the Jetson himself. When we meet, please grant your blessings. Thus, Gimpopa sang with tears of deep devotion. So that's a little bit from Gimpopa, a wonderful heart disciple of Milarepa. And now, just to end, I'm reading from another translation of another compilation of songs, teachings of Milarepa called Drinking the Mountain Stream, Songs of Tibet's Beloved Saint Milarepa. This is interesting. He's with a bunch of lay people in a village. And finally, he stayed with these people living in a cave nearby their village for 3 months. They begged him to stay longer, but he didn't listen. They said to him, "If you absolutely refuse to grant our request and stay and must leave us now, please give us some advice about practice in the future for this life and the next." So again, he's now giving teachings to a group of lay people. like us. Listen, great meditators, that's in quote, listen, great meditators, men and women. At best, you should do austere practice in desolate mountains for the rest of your lives. Next best is to wander the countryside, impartial, directionless, detached from this life. Next best, follow me, unattached to your homeland. And at least until self-sufficient, learn holy dharma from a true teacher, experience and realize, and remember the key points of practice. So he kind of, you know, there's a little hierarchy here. And finally, he gets to us. Where he says, until you are self-sufficient. Self-sufficient means what? You no longer need any teachings. You no longer need any guidance. Your capacity to lead the noble altruistic life is sufficient unto itself. You are self-sufficient. You don't need anything. But until you reach that point, learn the holy dharma from a true teacher, experience and realize, and remember to practice the key points. Avoid three faults of a pot. Sally remembers what the three faults of the pot are. Remember the, you know, dirty pot, upside down pot, pot with holes in it, when listening to dharma. So again, I'm reading some of these things because these are sort of like advice kind of things, good for the last day of retreat. Avoid three faults of a pot when listening to dharma. Restrain body, speech, and mind, and reflect on its meaning. Hang on well to the words that strike home. Right? Hang on well to the words that strike home. Strike home to you. Stem the outbreak of afflictive emotions. Right. Interesting. We have, highly developed systems to prevent the outbreak of epidemics, don't we? Right. But I'm not aware of any system we have in place to stem the outbreak of afflictive emotions. That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? You think you could look into that? Ken is a psychiatrist. He runs a mental health center. Could you kind of maybe, you know, afflictive emotions in East Asheville, quick. Send out the team.
Good. What about spontaneous positive, promoting positive emotions?
That might be it. Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes, that would be good. So let's not, only just stem the outbreak of disease, let's get people healthy. That's why you're here. Make fruitful the holy dharma you've heard. So he's sort of again saying, reflect on meaning, hang on to the words that strike home to you, make sure that your body-mind is not overtaken with afflictive emotions, stem the outbreak, and bring to fruit the holy dharma you've heard. About the things of this life, think as follows. About involvement in all complex affairs of politics and government, think thus. And we are, I think, unless something's happened, there is politics going on. So I thought this was germane. Desires achieved increase thirst like salt water. Interesting, right? We think that by achieving our desires, it's like a thirsty person, you know, drinks water and is satisfied. And he says, no. When you achieve your desire, it's really like a thirsty person drinking salt water. You're only what? Thirstier, you only want more. Interesting. Again, not the way we usually see it. Work has no end, like a river's ripples. Has anybody ever noticed that? Right? Work has no end. Right? You work hard all week to get this done and that done and this achieved and that project accomplished. And right? Right, June?
Yes.
And then what happens Monday morning?
Start over.
It has no end, right? And if you don't show up, you know what? They'll get somebody else. Just like that. 2 weeks, they won't even remember your name. Work has no end like a river's ripples. So you see, even though he lives way up in the mountains, he seems to understand something clearly. Prosperity and decline are like a pond's filling and drying, right? Like a pond, you know. The rainy season it fills up, dry season it dries out, rainy season it fills up, just prosperity and decline, up and down. Things go well, things don't go well. You gain, you lose. These preconceived obsessive emotions are a curtain which hides high birth and freedom. An iron hook dragging us to low birth and samsara. So he's saying this whole world of what she's talking about, of endless desires, endless projects, endless activity, endlessly working for prosperity and just seeing it go up and down, up and down, up and down. And all of the emotions and the obsessive thinking and mind states that are generated by this kind of life. He said it's a curtain, right? It prevents us from seeing. When he means high birth, he means high birth meaning born into the noble family. What's the noble family? The Buddha family. Born into, you know, a noble birth is to become an Arya, somebody who knows this truth about reality and freedom. It's even an iron hook that's dragging us deeper and deeper into this worldliness. The seeds of repeated growth of afflictions, a massive cloud raining down misery, a thief who robs us of our virtue and assets, the root that produces all our faults. To probe deep into those roots, that the ignorant confusion are you yourself, that all the conceptions and preconceptions you have are you yourself, and that all your thoughts and feelings and perceptions are envoys of agents sent by you yourself. From beginningless time till now, you've dragged yourself through the mire of bad actions in samsara's ocean. Is that clear? It's all self-created. And it stems from this obsessive involvement in worldly activity, not by the nature of the activity, but by the nature of our attachment and attraction to it and always looking to get something meaningful out of it. If I can just fulfill this desire, if I can just get this, if I can just lose that, if I can just get it just right. Whatever that is, and we all have our own list of all the that's that we're working on. Right? And he said, it's this absolute, complete, obsessive involvement in this and that and all the emotions that arrive from it. This is the very reason that we are endlessly dragging ourselves up and down, all around. Right. And they all are sent by ourselves. Then he says, now examine yourself closely. He's saying, examine yourself, meaning examine your true self. Examine your mind. Remember, he had the shepherd boy do that. Now examine yourself closely. You yourself have no color, no form. If sent, you won't go. If restrained, you don't stay. If looked for, can't be seen. If grasped, you can't be caught. This is your mind. previously ignorant of your own nature, you spun on the wheel of affliction in the ocean of life. Now in the mansion of concentration and physical composure, meditation, examine before you with your eyes of critical awareness and station behind the watchman of recollective awareness. Return to your natural state without effort or distraction. Know the way of such relaxation. Fortunate ones. How beautiful. Instead of all this endlessly obsessive activity directed toward gaining meaning and purpose and happiness out of this endless world of activity and desire and need and want. And he said, stop it. Turn inward. Examine your own mind, because it is the source of it all. Your whole drama of who you are and who you aren't and who they are and who they aren't, it's all self-created. You are the absolute complete author of the whole drama, and you have written every character in it, every character's description, you write it all. So he says, stop. It's not to stop it. And turn around and look into your own mind. And what are you going to discover? That your true self has no color, no form. You know, it doesn't, it comes, it goes, it doesn't come, it doesn't go. If you look for it, it can't be seen. If you try to grasp it, it can't be caught. And yet, there's something grasping. There's something looking. When you're ignorant of your own nature, you're endlessly spinning in the world of affliction. Now, in the mansion of concentration and physical composure, examine yourself with the eyes of critical awareness. Critical awareness means you are looking in a discerning way at your mind, at self, thoughts, at feelings, and really discerning clearly, what are these things? Are they real? Do they have substance? Right? You know, all those good questions. And stationed behind the watchman of recollective awareness, right? This is the key piece, right? Before you're examining everything with critical awareness, behind you of the watchman who's reminding you that that's what you're supposed to be doing. Many people don't have that piece, right? Oh, I know what to practice, I just forget to practice. Right? Oh, I know the practice of mindfulness, I just forget to practice mindfulness. Oh, I know I'm supposed to be looking into the nature of afflictive emotions rather than just letting them run wild in me. Oh, but I forget. Because we don't have the watchman of recollective awareness stationed behind us to remind us. Is that clear? You need both. And then return to your natural state. Who wouldn't want to return to your natural state? Be done with all this artifice. Be done with all this role playing. Be done with all this moving through various kinds of ego states with all their feelings and nonsense and drama. Return to your natural state, like a child. You know, we all once were children. We didn't have ego states, we didn't have issues. Can you imagine what your life would like if you had no issues at all? Free of all issues. Well, you were like that. It took you a while. It took you years to develop issues. First, you had to develop a self. Then you had to develop a developed self that could claim things for itself, want things for itself, name things for itself. See itself as an individual standing apart from everything else, and then it just went out into the world. But before that, you had no issues with anything or anyone. Return to your natural state without effort or distraction. If it is your natural state, you don't have to do anything This is the wonder of this practice. You don't have to do it. It is your natural state. The birds don't have to make an effort to be birds. Do they? No. It is their natural state. But we're all making such efforts to be ourselves. So return to your natural state without effort or distraction. Know the way of such relaxation. If you are not always in a state of relaxation, it is only because you yourself are causing tension in your body mind. Next time you're around a child, see how relaxed they are. Relax their bodies, relax their minds. Just naturally relaxed. Is your mind relaxed? Is your body relaxed? If not, it's because you misuse it. You abuse it. You fill it with nonsense. You fill it with drama. You fill it with afflictive mind states. No wonder you're not relaxed. Return to your natural state without effort or distraction. Know the way of such relaxation, fortunate ones. That's the way he ends. We are the fortunate ones. Why? Because we, for some unknown reason, but only because of our good fortune, we are able to hear such teachings. That show us another way how to live, another way how to be. We would have never figured this out ourselves. It is only because of the blessings of this lineage and these teachers that these teachings continue in this world and are made accessible to us. So we are fortunate. And we should remember we have good fortune. Because even though outwardly circumstances in your world may be going the way you want or not going the way you want, things may be going well or not going well, that is a kind of worldly fortune or misfortune. But all of us here have good fortune that we hear such teachings that allow us to know that no matter what the circumstances of our lives are, we all have the capability of happiness and well-being and meaning. Is that clear? Does anybody disagree? If you do, please ask a question. And just one more thing before we come to an end. This is toward the end of his life, and this is just a teaching about our true mind. Just to clear up, just want to clear up if there are any misconceptions. So, again, he's just up to his old stuff. He was invited by some people. He remained in their village a few days teaching the Dharma. He's traveling with his fellow Repus. They're traveling about. They stay in an abandoned house for the night, leave in the morning. On the way, they met a woman carrying water. Milarepa caught hold of the hem of her robe and said, "Hey, give us yogi some breakfast." He's quite a guy. Kind of just hanging out. "Hey, give us yogi some breakfast. We're hungry." "Greedy yogis," she replied, shaking the hem of her robe. "Where are you coming from, grabbing me and demanding that I provide for your belly? You should take care of my stomach. I'm sure that you have a place of your own. Go farm it and eat your own food. You have a human body just like mine." So Mila sang her a song about distinguishing the similar. I mean, it's quite interesting, you know. I mean, if you believe that somehow these are true and these anecdotes are true, I mean, it's quite something that he's just, I mean, you'll see the song, he sings it. I mean, she's just this, you know, some old woman that he's harassing for breakfast and kind of telling him to get lost. And this, so now he sings her this song. It's just amazing. The actual mind, clear and void, has been likened to space. But comparison of mind with space won't hold. For mind is aware, though void, while space is voidness, devoid of awareness. They're similar in their voidness, but very different in actuality. The actual mind, clear and void, has been likened to the sun and the moon. But comparison of mind with sun and moon won't hold. For mind is clear and unsubstantial, while sun and moon are clear but solid. They're similar in clarity, but very different in actuality. This actual mind, clear and void, has been likened to that mountain up there. So he uses, been likened to that mountain up there. But comparison of mind and mountain won't hold. For mind is uncompounded, while the mountain's composed of atoms. They're similar in their unchangingness, but very different in actuality. This actual mind, clear and void, has been likened to that river down there. But comparison of mind with river won't hold. For mind is uncompounded, while that river is the conflux of many streams. They're similar in their constant flow, but very different in actuality. This actual mind, clear and void, is said to be alike for me and you. But comparison of me with you won't hold. You're involved with mundane affairs, distracted with drudgery all day, stupefied with sleep at night, a slave to desire dawn till dusk. I'm an ascetic yogi. I work for the welfare of beings all day. I'm focused in clear light all night. Worshipping from dawn to dusk, we're similar in our human bodies, but very different in the success of our lives. The woman was deeply impressed and finally invited them into her house where she treated them with great respect. She had her hair cut, changed her name, and requested instruction for meditation practice, offering a nugget of gold for an initiation fee. Later, she became a woman of excellent realization. Quite something, eh? This Milarepa. And let me just read, before we come to an end, this is the closing verse of this text, which I... So it must be another song of his, even though it doesn't say. They call it the closing verse. I'm a yogi who wanders the countryside, a beggar who travels alone, a pauper who's got nothing. I left behind the land of my birth, turned my back on my own house, and gave up my fertile fields. I stayed in isolated mountain retreats, practiced in rock caves, surrounded by snow, and found food as birds do. That's how it's been up to now. There's no telling the day of my death, but I have a purpose before I die. That's the story of me, the yogi. Now I'll give you some advice. Everybody listening? He's got some advice for us. Trying to control the events of this life, trying to be so clever, always planning to manipulate your world, involved in repetitive social relations. In the midst of these preparations for the future, you arrive unaware at your final years, not realizing your brow is knit with wrinkles, not knowing your hair is turned white, not seeing the skin of your eyes sink down, not admitting the sag of your mouth and nose. Sounds like an advertisement for a plastic surgeon. Trying and trying to control the events of this life. Sound like anybody you know? Trying and trying to be so clever. Always planning to manipulate your world. Involved in repetitive social relations. And while this is all going on, what's happening? Unaware, we arrive at our final years. But, I mean, it's not even like that. I mean, you know, 20-year-olds are amazed when they arrive in their 30s. 30-year-olds are amazed when they arrive in their 40s. 40-year-olds are amazed when they, you know, I mean, it's just, we're just amazed that it's, time is passing and that we are aging. That at some point we will arrive at our final years. Do we know when our final years are? No, we don't, do we? We think they're somewhere off there. But we don't know. We don't know when our final years. We may be young, and these could be our final years. We don't know it. So it's unknown. Even while chased by the envoys of death, you still sing and rejoice in pleasure. Not knowing if life will last till morning, you still make plans for tomorrow's future. Not knowing where rebirth will occur, you still maintain a complacent contentment. Now's the time to get ready for death. That's my sincere advice to you. If its import strikes you, start your practice. So that's his closing verse. So if anything, you know, strikes you from this teachings, practice, start your practice. So again, kind of in summation, for many of us here, the life and teachings of Milarepa may seem unusual. We may have had problems with them. They are not the usual kind of teachings we listen to, nor is his the kind of life, of a life of a master that we are used to. And so it, again, could be possible to dismiss him in some way, put him off somewhere. But that would be missing the point. The interesting thing for Dharma is that at the end of the day, it's about practice. It's not about lifestyle. We can say that the life of a yogi, the life of a hermit, doesn't sound very nice for him, but we could say in modern parlance, that's a lifestyle he's chosen. It is a lifestyle of absolute and complete renunciation of all aspects of worldly life. Right? That is one way to solve the problem, isn't it? Right? I mean, one way to solve the problem of endless distractions, attachments, avoidances, etc., the whole drama of worldly life is what? To leave it. And so that path of renunciation, which is so extreme in him, is, I think, a reasonable solution. Right? If one sees that this that all the, you know, all the activities of this world is not going anywhere. Right? I mean, we could look at this political whatever is going on, this circus called an election that's going on, and go, what is this? Right? I mean, we are talking about issues that we thought were settled 40 and 50 years ago. And, you know, and it's endlessly back. And you can despair about that, or you could go, maybe there's a reason for this. Endlessly back and forth. Endless stop this. Right, left, right, 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 left. Maybe there's a deeper disease in the human But until that's taken care of, this basic unsatisfactoriness of human life, which is expressed in everything, including our politics, economics, takes on. So you can understand, well, somebody could look at all this and say, what? You know, pox on all your houses. This is all just crazy. Right? I'm out of here. Right? I mean, and that's understandable, isn't it? Yeah, right? I mean, those who are in it say, oh, no, if you vote for this one, this will happen, it will happen. But somebody takes a longer view, go, it's all nonsense. You know, you go up, you go down, back, forth. You know, underneath it all, it's greed, avarice, self-interest. Right? That's what it's all about. Manipulation, hypocrisy. So one path is the path of renunciation. You can see Milarepa may have it right. Especially when you saw those descriptions of the bucolic kind of you know, the streams and the meadows and the birds, and right, it sounded quite delightful. We may not want to live in a cave, just a little hut with indoor plumbing, you know. But still, right, you could say, yeah, it's not a bad life. And, you know, that hermit's life, that yogi's life, is actually, traditionally, was not unknown in civilizations. You know, if you go to a lot of the great civilizations of our time, Chinese civilizations, Japanese, very common for scholars and kings and, you know, highs of all, you know, to just give it all up and retire and go live in a little hut somewhere and write poetry and meditate and, you know, just kind of live that kind of life. Right? It was very common and acceptable, right? You know, enough of worldly activity. So, you know, the path of renunciation is one answer. You know, the lifestyle of the monk and the nun, and, you know, it is, again, a fairly extreme lifestyle that really only in Buddhism and I think Catholicism do those paths exist. You know, the celibate path is another path. It's not as extreme as Milarepa because, you know, they are living in community and they do interact a lot more with society, whatever. But that's another way of kind of, you know, not having to deal with worldly stuff. Right? Worldly relationships, family, houses and jobs and market. You know what I mean? And all that. Can you see? And that's... you know, I'll just devote myself to spiritual life and to helping other peoples in an organized, institutional way. It's sort of, you know, another way of going about it, right? Then there's us. And so who are we? So we are interesting. We're an interesting person. Because on the one hand, our lifestyle is the lifestyle of the household, right? We have houses. We have jobs. We have relationships. We have family. We have activities. We have our community. We have involvements, right? So in a certain way, we are living... that life that the yogis and the hermits and the monks and the nuns have rejected, have renounced, right? So we are living that life, aren't we? And unless we join them in their lifestyle, we are committed to living this life. So what is the solution for us? If we cannot or are unwilling to change the outer aspects of our life, then we have to change the inner aspects of our life. Outwardly, like Marpa, we appear like everybody else. We have our home, we have our wives and husbands and children and jobs, right? Just like Marpa, we appear like everyone else. But the way we inwardly live our life, the choices we make, this is where we have the capacity, as they say, of living in the world but not being of the world. Which means you're doing it, and it looks like you're doing it like everybody else, but you're actually doing it differently. And Milarepa actually gave us a teaching on that, didn't he? If you remember. I think maybe the first day. He said, your life consists of three things. Your meditative life, right, where you're really working diligently in the cultivation of mindfulness, concentration, insight, really cultivating all these insights he writes about in terms of the nature of mind, the nature of self, right? Coming to realization. And when you arise from your mat, remember he said your life consists of two things. Do you remember what those were? Meritorious actions and self-purification. Now this is what this means is that our life as lay people, we are using the circumstances of our life. Our circumstances of our life mean all our relationships. Circumstances of our life, all our experience. Circumstances of our life, all the ups and downs, back and forth, success, failures, etc., of our life, right? We are using them to wake up, to see clearly, to do what? To let go, to see into the empty nature of self, to generate loving kindness, compassion, understanding, right? To free all the actions of our body, speech, and mind, of all traits of egocentricity, narcissism, to free ourselves of the ego afflictions that come from living an egocentric, narcissistic life, and to learn from within to generate, it may not be a mind state as pure and as consistent as the yogi, right? Who has, because of their lifestyle, great opportunity, because they have no distractions and because they can single-mindedly meditate day and night, they and I can generate a certain kind of energy and understanding and clarity that is beyond most of us because of the way we live. But we still have the capacity through these wonderful teachings and practices of directly perceiving the nature of self, and through these practices that we have been taught, the many practices we've taught about how to lead an altruistic life, how to lead a bodhisattva's life, to practice the six paramitas, to practice the Eightfold Path, to understand deeply the nature of reality. We have the capacity to lead an awakened life as lay people. It's just a little more challenging, perhaps. But if you read the life of Milarepa, I mean, his life had challenges too. His life had difficulty too. Right? So different kind of challenges. But living in the midst of worldly desires, living in the midst of a world where everybody seems to agree that egocentricity is the way, and that a life of manipulation to get your goals and objectives met and all your egoistic needs met is what life's all about. If one doesn't have strong dharma, if one doesn't have strong practice, and if one doesn't have the support of the Buddha, the Dharma, and a strong community to support one, it is very easy to get what? Sucked in. The expression is The expression is your Dharma turning the world, or is the world turning your Dharma? If you have a good practice, a strong practice, your Dharma is turning the world. But if your practice is weak, the world is turning you. It's turning your Dharma. So again, the life of the awakened layperson, many of you, some of you have been to the retreats I did up at Southern Dharma on the Vimalakirti Sutra. I believe those talks are available on the website. There is a wonderful sutra where the major protagonist is a layman, fully involved in the full catastrophe of life, and is second to none in his realization. The Vimalakirti Sutra is a wonderful sutra to read about how to lead the life of as an enlightened lay person. And that is, that's the life we need to lead. But to do that, we have to be inwardly as clear, as dedicated, as sincere, as consistent as Milarepa was. We have to wake up in the morning and we have to set our intention for the day. How am I today? What is my plan for today to lead an altruistic life? How am I going to practice non-ego, non-self today? How am I going to generate today positive emotional states, happiness, joy, love, compassion, caring, patience, rather than anger, resentment, fear, worry, sadness, despair, judgment, right? That should be in our thoughts when we start the day, so we're clear. And we should, just like in retreat, we should check in with our intention throughout the day, to make sure we're on course, that our Dharma is turning the wheel of the world, and the world is not turning our Dharma. Right, Alex? 9 o'clock in the morning, the world started turning your Dharma. So stop, check in, start turning the wheel the other way. The stronger our practice is, the more consistent our practice is, we will find over time that we're able, in a more easier way, consistent way, to turn the world toward Dharma. At the end of the day, we should evaluate how we did in our evening meditation. Troubleshoot. Note your successes, note your failures. But you know what I'm saying, just in a very pragmatic way. Troubleshoot. See, how did I get caught up there? Look deeply into it. Why did I get stuck there? Why did I forget to practice all afternoon and let all my habitual mind just kind of run me? Just examine yourself. Watch your mind. Rededicate yourself. Get up the next day, fresh day. It's a brand new day, 24 hours. Start again. Is there anything not clear? Good. So why don't we end